When there is fear for the physical body, you would experience a constriction in the base chakra, actual tensing of the muscles of the anus and the rectum. And we all have experienced that. That's where we experience fear many times at that level, as that chakra becomes blocked. The etheric, as I say, the chakra associated with that is the hara, it's called in Zen. It's an energy center right below the navel and kind of interior to it, about an inch and a half below it and a couple of inches inside. And an energy, it connects us, that's where we experience this energy, this chi energy that flows through the etheric body, being governed from that center. Now that is also conspicuously close to the navel, isn't it? Which is where we received a very important energy at one time from the mother. Our life was connected with her life. And so through this hara, our life is still connected to a larger life. Sometimes that hara is called a second brain. And as you grow in the spiritual life, especially in a contemplative spirituality, you can tell how you're doing sometimes just by how relaxed you are right there. Whenever there's stress, you will experience a constriction in the hara, or in that chakra, and also constriction in the basal chakra. Well, after that, you won't be able to have any other energies from above breaking through until there's some relaxation there. The astral body is associated, especially with the second and third chakras as well. Sometimes that second chakra is placed in the vicinity of the reproductive organs because it's such an important source of energy and emotion. But frequently, the third chakra is associated with the solar plexus. That chakra is feeding energy into that system of nerves and the organs that are associated with those nerves. The mental is associated with the heart and the throat, the heart being the place where the emotional and the physical come together. In the Hebrew literature, they spoke of the heart as the source of one's thoughts and will. It's a very good way of talking about how the mental body and the astral body come together, where they connect, where their energies interpenetrate and exchange. The throat, the ability to express our thought, the powers of the throat to communicate our reality. And finally, the higher spiritual is associated with the opening of the third eye and the crown, the two energy centers, the third eye being rooted in the core of the brain and at the top of the head. Okay. Here's another way of looking at these different bodies. We say they each have different frequencies, the physical having a lower frequency than the etheric and the astral and so forth. The physical and the etheric and the astral living in space-time kind of a reality, and the mental and above living in a beyond space-time, and yet manifesting in space and time as well. And again, these are connected, they are communicating with each other, but they each have their own specific frequency. Here they break up the mental into three different levels. And we talked a little about that, about contained with sensory, contained with higher abstract, and so forth. So again, each of the chakras is associated with the development of the powers of one of these bodies or levels of our human nature, and provides an energy relaying an energy exchange place. Now, there's a different motive associated with each of these as well. Here's an interesting thing that comes from a little book on meditation by Edgar Cayce. Cayce tried to associate the chakras with the endocrine system, and there have been others who have done that, who have said the chakras are more related to endocrine glands than they are to nerve plexuses. And I think it's probably true that they're related to both. So the first chakra is probably not just related to the base of the spinal cord, but to the endocrine system. And what's interesting about the endocrine system is the endocrine system and the central nervous system are the means by which the whole body is affected to respond to a certain situation. Endocrine gland secretions go through the whole body, just as nerve impulses frequently can direct the activity of the whole body. Well, he took the Lord's Prayer, as you see here, and showed how the Lord's Prayer addresses the concerns of all of the chakras. And he divided it into two sections, on earth as in heaven. On earth is everything below the fifth chakra. In heaven is everything above. And so we begin the Lord's Prayer with Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Very high spiritual convictions there. And then thy kingdom come. And then he just goes around in the Lord's Prayer and shows us how when we pray the Lord's Prayer, we're really praying in all of these chakras. It's addressing the motives and concerns of them all. Well, I thought that was pretty interesting. Let me show you a couple of other pictures, and then we'll take a little pause and finish going through this, see what kind of questions we have. Isn't it a fun little picture for you to look at while I pick up this stuff? As you can see, there are books which attempt to draw this kind of subtle energy physiology out for us. You can find books that draw the whole acupuncture meridian system out in great detail. This one is an attempt to illustrate the movements of the kundalini energy through the throat chakra into the third eye and above into the crown. And you'll see three channels usually associated with that energy, three most important. This one is called the Pengala. It's associated with the heat or the yang principle or male energy. The other one on this side, the Ida, associated with the moon or coldness, our female energy. And finally, one up the center. And from my own experience, this was how I first really became interested in this. I could feel very acutely the movement of this energy from the throat around the ear and turning the corner and having a terrible time turning the corner, I might add. But then after breaking through that, really coming very powerfully to rest in the center of the forehead and opening up thereby this third eye, this new way of seeing, that is a seeing beyond dualism, seeing things without judgment or evaluation, a seeing in silence and acceptance. And then moving to the crown, which is around the head. Now, at this point, I want to do something fun with you before opening up with questions and answers. We've seen these chakras, and I might just add one more thing. There are usually colors associated with each of them that can be seen in a deep silence. And there are usually sounds associated with them. And if you look on that sheet, as you go through these sounds, there are sounds that resonate with each of these centers. Some people meditate on these chakras using colors and sounds. They use color as a creative visualization. They'll visualize red. Shirley MacLaine has a whole videotape doing this particular thing. Or they'll repeat this sound again and again. Ultimately, the higher chakras are responding to the sound of Om, which contains all the sounds. It is said Aum, A and U, or like the Alpha and Omega, and then the M is everything between. In glossolalia, here's an interesting thing. All that one is doing is mumbling these sounds. So one tie-in to the Pentecostal thing that I've seen is, again, my own experience in glossolalia, these chakras are very powerfully stimulated and cleansed and released of energy blockages. So that a person praying in tongues will say shamana namanagan. You know, they're doing all these sounds. And if you look over these sounds here, you're seeing the same kinds of basic sounds that a person practicing Kundalini yoga will deliberately repeat, you know, to open that chakra and to vibrate it. So what I'd like to, we have a question, but what I'd like to do before we get into many questions is just say, what are some of your experiences of how our tradition alludes to the existence of these chakras? What are some ways you see these chakras indicated in our tradition? And I'd invite you to just look at this character here and his predicament. Let me start you off. Did you ever see a picture of a saint that has a star in the middle of his or her forehead? Did you ever see a monk who shaved his head in this fashion here? I might add there's another chakra above the head that's not often spoken of. It's a very definite part of my experience. Did you ever see a person with a crown or a flame of fire above the head? Or a pearl in the throat? Many, many pictures of Our Lady have a pearl in the throat, a blue one at that. And blue, as you can see, is the color associated with that throat chakra. The color associated with the crown is purple. What does purple mean in our tradition?
Royalty.
Yes.
Power.
It's royalty, but really high development, you know. What colors do the vestments manifest through the seasons? What does that have to do with chakras? Could it be that vestments are an attempt to portray the human aura? That the sentiments expressed in a particular liturgical feast are sentiments that resonate with the concerns of that chakra? See, I think there is a subtle anatomy that is understood in our tradition and alluded to, but probably more as a subconsciously, I'm searching for the right word here, it's understood to be there. It's given testimony by Christian artists especially, who probably sometimes knew darned well what they were doing, but could not express what they were trying to say in the realm of theology. So they did it through art. So they'll show light coming into the forehead, or light. If you go in Rome and you look at the pictures, it is just gold light radiating from the top of the head in the crown shape many times. What is that sacred heart business all about? See, sometimes the tradition gives us a symbol that is very definitely focused on the chakra, and there's no question that the most important chakra is the heart. This is where the spiritual journey begins, is in the opening of the heart to a concern beyond myself. The development of the heart chakra takes us to the place of self-responsibility, and in a spiritual sense, that now means I just don't think about myself. My responsibility to myself must entail concern for others, compassion, and so forth. And can you think of any other allusions to the chakras or this kind of metaphysical anatomy in our tradition? Yes.
That just keeps coming to me is chanting.
Chanting, yes. Yes. Frequently in our chanting, in the Gregorian especially, ums and ohms and ahs are held for a long period of time. Yeah. Yeah, things like that. All right. If you want to hear that om come out, go to it again, a charismatic prayer meeting. They don't know they're doing this. They just stone me. I've never been invited to talk on this, by the way, at a charismatic convention, nor do I expect to be invited, even though I obviously have great sympathy with what they're doing here. But there will be times in a prayer meeting when people will begin singing in tongues. And ultimately, you know, they'll go on and on, and the syllables will become fewer and fewer, and then there's just a harmonizing, beautiful kind of om sound that's going along there. Yes?
But you said earlier that the psyche is not at the will. So on some level, the body, the mind, the soul does know. It's just that we're not in harmony.
It's responding, yes.
But in some level,
yeah.
The psyche is, not at will. Do it because we know that it has some kind of healing power.
Yeah, what a spiritually open person is doing is spontaneously responding to influences that lead them toward wholeness and harmony and love. Maybe without understanding the occult implications of that.
Which is power greater than ourselves.
I'm certainly saying that if this thing we've gone through here tells us something about our basic human nature, not Hindu human nature, but human nature, then why should we be surprised when charismatics are speaking in tongues and uttering these syllables? And why should we be outraged if what these syllables are doing is vibrating the chakras and releasing them from all kinds of negative energies and influences? And why shouldn't we then praise God all the more for directing this kind of inner transformative process in and through our nature? Yes.
Then I have a hard time understanding that, and having attended charismatic meetings and knowing a lot of having charismatic friends. But what happens then when they are drawn back into fundamentalism rather than transcending and moving toward the mystical?
Well, okay. Considering what we talked about here, then you tell me the answer. What are they doing? What is the person doing when they've experienced a spiritual opening and the energy about that, but then they move toward a very strict and rigid dogmatic kind of attitude? What is happening? At the mental level, there's a constriction that's taking place, and they begin to cut themselves off, ultimately. Yes.
Based on our previous cultural programming?
No, not necessarily. They can be getting some new programming. You know, fundamentalism isn't always going back to something we were once taught and implanting that on the center stage. It's frequently picking up some new conditioning. So they have an experience, that is a beyond mental. It's in the spiritual level, and it's touching them from body to toe. It's only natural for them at the mental level to say, for the mental level to seek its own particular kind of understanding of this, which is conceptual and paradigmatic, and to say, now what does this mean? So for the experience to be integrated, for any spiritual experience to be integrated, there has to be some kind of understanding at the mental level. Well, their understanding, that they receive is of such a nature that it's got some judgment in it, it's got some narrow-mindedness in it, it's not open in it, and so that's how a potentially powerful transformative experience can turn into an idealism that is schismatic. Okay, in the worst of cases, that's what can happen. The problem is at the mental level. In fact, most of our problems are really at the mental level and at the emotional as well, of course. Yes.
Actually see an aura?
Seeing auras belongs to the realm of psychic gifts that I talked about earlier, that some people can do easier than others under certain circumstances. Some people are born with the ability to do that. Their psychic gifts are very extreme and pronounced, and just normal psychic energy is all they need in order to see auras and stuff. Some people have seen strong auras from birth. Probably everybody from time to time can see something like that under the right circumstances. Yes. Did I make a mistake?
No.
Oh, I said the right thing? Okay. Yeah, I know my spiritual director can see auras, and it's one of the ways that she works with me. She'll say, oh, your left knee is just a mess today. It's just, and of course, the left knee is not really the left knee there. It's part of that mystical physiology. It's really about some part of my attitude here that, you know, so I say, well, what does my left knee need then? I joke around with her on this, but again, it's different people have that gift. I don't have that. If I had any of these gifts, I probably stayed stuck there. I don't have enough faith to transcend those things. So God knew better than to give me any psychic gifts. Yeah.
Which body would direct the lifespan of the physical body?
Well, all of them. Now again, the physical body is also the recipient of the genetic intelligence. And so if there's something that the physical body is receiving through its genetic ancestry that has one of these congenital diseases where, you know, I can't think of one right off the bat, but some of those where around midlife you die. What is it?
Try alcoholism.
Well, alcoholism is another one, yeah. If you drink, you're probably going to develop alcoholism. So that would be an example where the genetic code would influence our lifespan. But for most people who inherit a normal, you know, basically okay genetic system of intelligence, without some kind of, you know, rare disease carried along in that, probably their thinking and their feeling experiences are going to have the greatest determination on how long they live. Yeah. Yeah.
And this is impeding a realization of a higher level. Is this a constant, or can that be overcome?
Any of these things can be transcended. So, if, for example, what people are doing who are doing inner child work, for example, wounding of the inner child is a wounding of that emotional level of our being, and when that lower level is damaged, even though you read Norman Vincent Peale and develop a higher, you know, positive self-concept and so forth, what about the wounding there? So it has to be addressed as an emotional issue and not just as a negative attitude, you would say. And once some healing happens, then one can move on and grow. Yeah, any of those levels. Now, you know, some of these things are irreversible. If we have caused some damage in our body, well, it won't go away. There'll be a scar. And I think that just as there are scars in the physical body, there must also be scars in the etheric. In fact, I know there are. I know there are places in my own energies, you know, that just block. I don't know why. The image I get when I do visualization meditation with that is that there's a block there. There's a scar there. And an energy channel that was flowing along comes to this thing, and it just has to just wiggle its way around all kinds of stuff until it can break through. So I think we have etheric scars, and we have astral or emotional scars, and we have mental scars as well. But thank goodness they're scars and not open bleeding wounds. Even the Christ who comes back from death has scars, right? He still carries his scars, so maybe in eternity we don't lose our scars, but we do lose our wounds. Maybe one more and we'll eat some food. Yes?
We were asking about some of the symbology in Christian systems.
Yeah, think about that.
In the Old Testament, I think there's a reference to a lampstand in the temple with seven lights on it.
Oh, the number seven.
And the number seven.
Watch that thing.
Seven churches, seven lights, seven stars in the sky. That's one. Okay, I'd like to stretch your mind a little bit and suggest that perhaps the crucifixion scene with Christ in the middle and the two other guys on the side might in some way correspond to the three channels that you're talking about here. That's a real iffy speculation there.
Well, okay. I think all those things can resonate with that level of subconscious understanding. That's quite possible. But the number seven just comes up in not only our tradition, but in others so many times. You know, St. John writes to the seven churches. And the concerns in those letters pretty well correspond to the concerns of the seven chakras. St. Teresa has seven mansions in her developmental process, doesn't she? And you're moving from a spirituality that's concerned with, you know, at the gate, well, gosh, you just are barely out of jail, you know, in that level of development, to finally a unitive experience that is such a profound oneness with God in that seventh mansion. So I think, you know, this keeps coming up again and again and again, this seven thing. And why is that? Maybe there's a seventh stage something or another going on with us. That again, I think the Hindus have named, especially that particular yogic tradition has named very well, and tried to work with directly. They've tried to work directly with these chakras and these energies and these sounds and these colors to move one's development along. That's what Kundalini Yoga does, certainly. Tries to work directly with that. You have a person who's really made the journey, is trying to help those who are on the journey, and they're using this understanding and these tools. Well, we can use them too, but in a little different way. Okay? Why don't we stop here, since I think the food is ready. Okay, we've hopefully had a little time to get some blood sugar circulating from the stomach to all over the place. And wake up a bit after the early afternoon doldrums. I'd like to begin with an opportunity for questions and comments. We didn't have much time for that at the end of our last session. We covered a lot of ground, though, yes.
You were talking about the different bodies and how they, the physical body and the other ones sort of follow the pattern around. And I realize in the physical body, it receives its sustenance from foods and the other nutrients. On these other ones, past the ethereal body, what maintains, say when the body dies, or what feeds these things, or if the body dies, where do these other things go, or what, do they implode, or what?
Oh, that's like the questions that kids ask, what happens to my dog when he dies? It's that kind of question, okay. Let me see if I can find the handout that would help us with that question. Of course, the first and most honest answer is, how should I know? But we can speak theoretically. All right. All right, there's the different levels or bodies or dimensions. So as we said, the physical body, when we die, we know decomposes ultimately into other organic and sometimes inorganic chemicals as well, which are recycled in the whole living process. They're taken up by other humans, animals, or whatnot. These etheric energies also do that as well. This chi energy is an energy that is a cosmic kind of an energy that is, it's extracted from our foods on the one hand, so it's contained in foods. There's more of it in some foods than in others, but it's also out there in the atmosphere. It's a very subtle life kind of an energy, which is why most people, when they sit outside for a little while, feel better. If ever you don't feel too good, go sit outside. That's a very good way to feed your etheric body, is to sit in the sun and feel the breeze. And so that energy will just simply, when we die, and that energy which was flowing through this etheric body will be made available for everyone else. And we don't hold on to it anyway. This is just as with our physical body, matter is constantly coming in and leaving. So with this etheric body, it's not something that we have that we hold on to. This chi energy goes through it, we inhale it, it comes in all through the body, it comes in through our foods, and we exhale it, and it exits throughout the body. And the astral body is a little different. It's not something that you consume, you know. It's not an energy that you receive from food. Not exactly. It's nevertheless a kind of an energy that does break down. Now, some of it we may take along with us to the extent that it becomes integrated into the higher mental and spiritual levels. Okay, so is that what your question? What happens to these lower bodies? All right. So you would say that a dog, for example, was a shared, like we do, it has a physical body, it has an etheric body, and it has an astral body, but dog style. Okay, it's got a dog soul, and its dog soul goes up to this kind of frequency. Maybe the curve won't be as high, or something like that. But so when it dies, that kind of energy is released. Now, what happens to all this astral energy that is making the rounds? Okay, this is where, you know, maybe it stays around. Maybe the emotional energy released when we die is in some way there in the collective unconscious for the whole race to be poisoned by. Okay, that's one way of looking at it, of how that kind of energy is still hanging around in some way, maybe even in a kind of a personal form, that it will have some personal characteristics. The Buddhist, in speaking of what happens to a consciousness that's unenlightened when one dies, will speak of this thing just kind of continuing to go around, not as an immortal soul, but as a karmic collection of energies. By that, they just mean a bundle of emotional kind of an energy that is still there for other human beings to be affected by. You know, this really is getting to be it's kind of difficult to answer some of those things. So that's the best we can do probably at this point. Yes?
Philip, can I go back to that chart you just had up before that, of those energy centers in the body there?
This one is associated with the central nervous system.
No, not that one. The one that was, you just had up there.
The Lord's Prayer.
The Lord's Prayer.
Okay.
And looking at that chart, I'm thinking, are we saying that there are certain, like, energy centers in the body located in these places that if they become fixed, that they have to somehow or another be opened up in order to be to function healthily?
Yes.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I might perceive, if I were perceiving this way, which I could see possibly as a problem, sometimes it's twofold. One is a hierarchical problem. We're up here in the head that we glorify a lot of heady stuff in our time. The other is that I think there's a big possibility of kind of a sexual hang-ups that on number four, we got male gonads as being the bread of our daily bread. And the female is like the source of temptation. That goes back to the garden of paradise where Eve is the source of temptation. The ovaries symbolize that. I don't think that's what is being said in there, but it sort of like looks like that's an innuendo there that could be picked up, that if I look at number six over there, Leiden is, or rather the female, whatever, I can't see too clearly.
The Leiden is not with the female gonads.
Okay. All right, the bottom sexual part.
The Leiden is a small endocrine gland that both male and female have.
You know, it's sort of like, that can't be associated with sort of like the mystical part of the life. You know, that's
no, all that
to get rid of.
All that, Casey was more inclined to associate the chakras on a physical level with the endocrine system than he was with the central nervous system. Okay, that's really what this is saying. And then when it came to the motives implicit in the chakras, security, power, and so forth, going up the line, he was just trying to demonstrate here that the Lord's Prayer touches on all those different kinds of concerns. And so to truly pray the Lord's Prayer is to plug ourselves into God in all of these levels. That's all he's really trying to say. But whenever he pictures the chakras, he's much more inclined to refer to endocrine connections than nerve plexus connections. I think it's both.
So he's not saying any one point is more godly than the other point.
Nobody's going to say that. No, I'm not going to say that either. That, you see, these chakras are all centers that communicate to us something about what it means to be human, and through these centers we experience something of God. So it's hierarchical in the sense that the growth process does move from the lower to the higher, but hierarchical should not here imply better than, that a fifth chakra person is more human in some way than a child or an infant. Okay, that's simply not true. But there are some things they know that the others don't know, and that's just about age and maturity. That's all. But there is an experience of God in all of these centers. And I'm going to talk about that. Anything else before to move on? Not many questions.